colloque. Une retransmission proposée par Canal Académie.
My proposition is that the dynamics of naval warfare are largely derived from the nature of the sea, the nature of the domain in which it operates. And I think there are four attributes of the sea that I need to identify. The first is that it's a stock resource. It has resources, fish, oil, gas, who knows what else in the future. Even now, 20% of the world's protein is gathered from the sea directly. That makes it important in human history. Secondly, it's always performed the function of today's internet. It's a way of discovering new information, transmitting ideas, the view over the near horizon. Today's internet phrases illustrate that point. We surf the net, we navigate the system. It's very maritime in conceptual origin, and to a large extent still is. 95% of digital information is transmitted through cables on the bottom of the sea, so it's still important from that point of view. But the two attributes that I'm mainly going to talk about are the attributes of the sea as a means of dominion and strategic manoeuvre, and secondly, the attributes of the sea as a flow resource, a means of transportation. So let me first of all say a little bit about the sea as a means of dominion. It's encapsulated by this picture of Oman of 1775. You can see that it offers Oman, which was then a maritime empire, a means of launching expeditions to other areas. It was a secure, safe harbour. It was a maritime empire. But the sea, as well as being, if you like, a springboard for action, was also a source of vulnerability. It's a place from which you can be attacked, hence the need to defend the base, as you can see, with those very powerful fortifications that were built to defend the naval base. So the sea, if you like, is both a means of attack and a source of vulnerability. And that is an essential element, if you like, of the nature of naval warfare. Thinking about something so important in human history was largely tactical until the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century. How to operate your fleets when in contact with the enemy. But through the 19th century, there was so much change, technological, social, cultural, economic, that people started to accept the need to think about naval warfare strategically. And one of the first to do so in a wholesale and coherent fashion was Alfred Thayer Mahan, an American who wrote in the 1890s and into the first 10 years of the 20th century. His basic proposition was that the sea had dominated human behaviour. It was interesting that in the last talk we had a discussion about the Mongols, about the dominance, if you like, of land power. Mahan took the view, on the contrary, that it was sea power that had determined human destiny, not land power. And that's what he said. Control of the sea by maritime commerce and naval supremacy means predominant influence in the world and is the chief among the merely material elements in the power and prosperity of nations. I'll talk more about that, this, in a moment. But for the moment, I just want you to concentrate on the words maritime commerce, because this takes us to that fourth attribute of the sea, a flow resource, a means of transportation. This is at the centre of one of the two main functions of sea power, and always has been. It's about, if you like, the attack and the defence of trade. We need to understand the role of the sea in this. This is a long quotation by a completely unknown British jurist writing in 1920, which sums it up, I think, really well. Here you have talking about the sea, here you have an almost limitless expanse and without a barrier, the ocean, now nature's great medium of communication. There are no difficult mountains to cross, no scorching deserts. The way lies open, a road that leads everywhere, the broadest and busiest of highways, open to all, used by all, vital to the modern structure of civilization. That summarizes it, particularly the phrase, a road that leads everywhere. That was and is the function of sea power as a means of transportation. Generally speaking, the cheapest way of transmitting goods and material about the world, and very frequently the safest. For that reason, Mahan thought, countries that dominated sea transportation would have undue influence in the affairs of the world. And this is a tradition that you can trace back to prehistory. Here's a much more recent version of it. This is a 14th century merchant ship. If you look carefully, you can see the faces of the rather anxious merchants peering out through the portholes in the side of the ship. You see an allusion to the wealth of the sea and the fishes below. And if you have really good eyesight, you can see the fact that the planks of that ship are sewn together with coconut fibre, not nailed, which was the technology of the time, but limited ships to coastal operation rather than oceanic, because they weren't strong enough to take storms at sea on the open ocean. Technology then, right at the heart of this, always changing, and I suppose the most dramatic form today is that the container ship, now transporting in one ship the contents of several Second World War convoys in one ship, transforming and increasing the merchant shipping industry, and the shape of the world economy. And this has been a process that's been going on for some very considerable time. But look at the exponential rate of the growth of sea trade before the Second World War and after it. In basically speaking, in the colonial era of sea trade, as opposed to the free trade era of sea trade. And there seems no reason to suppose that this trend will cease. The growth of the world's population, the growth of expectations of a growing middle class in the developing world suggests that this process will carry on indefinitely. And what it's creating is this. This is a map of the world produced a few years ago by plotting radio transmissions from ships in, I think it was a week. And some things stand out really clearly. The dominance of the northern hemisphere over the south, the shape of some of the major sea routes across the North Atlantic and the North Pacific, across the Indian Ocean as well. But one thing is not so obvious, and in fact, that's what's significant about it. With the exception of Australia, in the bottom right-hand corner, this does not pick out countries. Countries, if you like, are constituents of a system that operates over and above them that's wholly dependent on shipping, We call it globalization. So this technological economic development has transformed the nature and the role of sea shipping, and with it, the function of navies in the attack and defense of trade. In a sense, this simply brings up to date one of the assumptions that Mahan made, and I'd like to show you this quite long quotation from something he wrote in, I think it was 1902. It's worth studying. He was talking about what he thought was a world system. In fact, he even used the phrase, an articulated system. Vast increase in the rapidity of communications, multiplying and strengthening the bonds, knitting together the interests of nations to one another. But notice the phrase picked out in red. This is a globalized system that's very vulnerable, partly because of its dependence on sea transportation. And so the argument goes that these days, and before as well, one of the major tasks of navies was to defend trade, and indeed potentially to attack it in war. But increasingly, as trade has been seen as part of a globalized system, navies have adopted the notion of defending the system rather than just trade. It's defending trade and the conditions for trade. It's defending the system as well as the national interest by what they do at and from the sea. Here's an example, a British example, a British destroyer escorting a British tanker during the Iran-Iraq Gulf and tanker wars of the 1980s. In common with ships from the US, other European countries, Russia, the function of navies was to defend trade directly at sea and the conditions for trade by what navies could do from the sea. So, in peacetime, a major function of naval operations, something for which navies have always taken seriously. Clearly, something so strategically important is going to be an objective in war. And hence, for that reason, the attack and the defence of trade has always been a component of naval warfare. And I'm just going to talk about one example, one very obvious example of that, in the Second World War. This was a critical battle, the Battle of the Atlantic, for one really very simple reason. If you added the populations of the Allies together, 359 million people, something like 60% of the industrial output of the world, compared to 139 million people of the Axis, and something like 17% of world industrial output. The conclusion is inescapable. If the Allies can, if you like, get their act together, if they can move material and people around the world as they need to strategically, the odds were on their winning the war. If they couldn't, the odds were much better from the Axis side. So the centrality of the battle for sea communications can't be disputed. The Germans were perfectly well aware of that, and hence the Battle of the Atlantic. Technology was important in this, of course. This shot of a German U-boat symbolises the problems that the Germans had. The submarines that they were using were hardly submarines. They were more submersibles. They weren't designed for operations on the open ocean against trade in that kind of way. But that's what Dönitz had to fight with. The object of the campaign was twofold. First of all, to interfere with and interdict military forces being and military supplies being transported around the world. So attacking sea communications as a sort of strategic transportation, but secondly, also attacking the supplies that kept the war economies of the belligerents going, particularly, of course, the UK. And Japan, let's never forget Japan. The battle was complex, fluctuating, dominated by a whole series of different factors that influenced outcomes and solutions. It was finally won, as you can see, with the decline of the red indicator, which is how much tonnage of shipping is being sunk, and the rise of the purple indicator of submarines sunk on the other side. What won it? A whole mixture of responses. Convoy and escort was a critical part of the operation, of course, of success. The availability of aircraft, including bombing of submarine pens, factories in Germany making lenses for periscopes and submarines and all of that. But more importantly, aircraft for both locating submarines and in direct support of convoys themselves, organic air power going with the convoy, if you like. Tactics and anti-submarine technology, a constant battle of the backroom boys, the scientists on both sides, again producing big oscillations in success rates. Ultra, intelligence derived from reading the signals of German submarines and deducing from them the aspirations and intentions of the enemy, was also critical. What's not so obvious is the impact of industry on producing ships, merchant ships, faster than the U-boats can sink them, on producing goods and military supplies in quantities that could afford a certain loss rate, and so on. Also, logistical efficiency. This was a business dominated by the same considerations that FedEx uses today. This was a supply chain. So efficiency in getting the manufactured goods from the factory to the port of departure, and then from the port of arrival to the end user, was a business process. And the more logistical efficiency, the greater success. And many other characteristics as well, not least demand reduction, trying to reduce civilian demand in the economy through rationing and things of that sort. This was a strategic campaign of industrialized countries, a total war in every sense of that word. And everything was at stake. We need to reflect on what happened to Japan in consequence of their losing this war against largely American submarines in the last couple of years of the war. They were defeated before the atom bombs were dropped. But now people argue that such considerations are irrelevant, that it's inconceivable to think of another battle of this sort. And so argue that the nature of the defence of trade and the conditions for trade has been transformed by all of these developments. And these are comfortable assumptions that argue that fundamentally, in peacetime at any rate, the task of navies is to cooperate to defend trade and the conditions for trade by maintaining good order at sea. The conditions, in other words, in which merchant ships can proceed and do their jobs in safety, and that this is a cooperative rather than a competitive function, and that we're now seeing a swing, if you like, of interest away from one notion of the defence of trade to another. But you can challenge these comfortable assumptions. This map, for example, illustrates several things. One of the arguments, for example, is that close economic interdependency between the UK and Germany in 1914, they were both each other's largest trading partners, did not stop the Second World War. That human behaviour and political behaviour, if you like, is driven by more than simply economic rationality. Such things can happen and have happened historically. In the 1990s, President Hu of China started talking about what he called the Malacca Dilemma. And that was a reference to the fact that China, along with Korea and Japan, are wholly dependent on oil and other energy commodities coming in from Africa and from the Gulf and squeezing into those very narrow Straits of Malacca, and therefore vulnerable to pressure by an adversary or to a lack of good order at sea. He proposed a whole series of Chinese responses, which we're now seeing coming to fruition, which include, obviously, building up a substantial ocean-going Chinese navy for the first time in several hundred years. We can also see another area in which trade has been recently disrupted on this same map, and that, of course, is off the Gulf of Somalia, where the conditions for trade, the conditions for trade at sea have been disrupted by the activities of Somali pirates. Admittedly, only something like 2% of ships transiting the region have been attacked, but nonetheless, this has attracted a lot of attention. And we have seen other examples of limited forms of the attack and defence of trade, the attack and defence of shipping, in which the sea as a means of transportation has been central. I've already referred to the tanker war, piracy, even in a sense the Falklands War. I'll come back to that later on. So it's still there. This historic function, which has been so central to conceptions of naval warfare, it's changed, but it's still there to a greater or lesser extent. The second major function of sea power and naval warfare historically has been the projection of maritime power. That other great English-speaking maritime strategist is Sir Julian Corbett, famous largely for making the very obvious point that it's where navies have an impact on affairs on land that they are at their strategic, at their most effective strategically. So influencing events ashore and defending against the possibility that an adversary might do the same is central to Sir Julian Corbett's proposition. That's what navies are for. Hence the quotation that everybody knows. Since men live upon the land and not upon the sea, great issues between nations at war have always been decided, except in rarest cases, either by what your army can do against your enemy's territory and national life, or else by the fear of what the fleet makes it possible for your army to do. And this, in contemporary terminology, has led to people arguing that the strategic significance of the sea is fundamentally that it's the world's greatest manoeuvre space. It offers opportunities for strategic outflanking. We saw some examples of strategic outflanking in the last talk, but this is at the operational level. This is strategic outflanking. This is outflanking on an enormous scale, and operational and tactical as well, of course. It offers the opportunity to go round centres of gravity, to attack the adversary at his weakest, where he's not expecting it, rather than at his strongest, where he is. Corbett talked a great deal about forced dispersion. His examples, and his historians, you might wonder about this, was the Seven Years' War, where his argument was that the threat of a British naval amphibious descent on the coast of France forced France to defend the coastline and made concentration at the vital point where engaged with in central battle with its continental neighbours much more difficult. On a smaller scale, you can see the same argument operationally being applied to the Germans in 1944. They were unsure where the Allies were going to land along the coast of occupied Europe, and so had to defend all of it. That made concentration on the vital point more difficult. And even after the landings in Normandy, there was still great uncertainty as to whether that was the real thing or whether it was a feint and delayed German reinforcements to the threatened area. So basically, defence against this has been a major task, not just for armies, but for navies too. And this has introduced a whole new set of ideas about what navies do and what's their justification. And I'm sorry for the very long quotation I'm going to show you, but this is the Soviet expert in the mid-1920s, a naval thinker. We often identify with the classical sea powers and try to operate like they do. The Battle of Jutland is our model, which we study and attempt to imitate. Admirals Beatty and Spee, they are our role models. That which we learn from foreigners is good. But he said, in Russian conditions, that's not correct. We have other forces, other means, and we operate under different conditions. Consequently, it's necessary to work out the tactics for a small navy, which acts together with the army according to a single strategic plan. And what he and the Soviet New School, as they were generally known, had in mind was for a limited Soviet navy, which was very limited in the 20s and 30s, especially the early 30s, to use new technology in the shape of mines, coastal submarines, land-based aircraft, land-based artillery, and so on, to defend the coastline of the Soviet Union against the possibility of Western attack. And his argument was that not only was this all that the Soviet Union could do, but it was all that was necessary. And there was no need to follow the Mahanian image of what naval warfare was. Interestingly, in the Cold War, you see exactly the same kind of thinking actually applied by the Norwegians against the Soviet Union. So fundamentally using topography, the maritime geography, the maritime context, exploiting new technology in the shape of mines, torpedoes, fast attack crafts, coastal submarines, to deny that area to incoming forces, in this case from the Soviet Navy. So here the focus, if you like, is on defeating amphibious operations rather than conducting them. And how to do that? Well, most thinkers, most practitioners have always assumed that an amphibious operation depends on having command of the sea. How could you possibly conduct an amphibious operation involving towing an artificial harbour across the channel to win the logistics race with Germany without having sea control? If something like this was subjected to serious naval attack, it would be strategically disastrous. But there were other challenges too, and I've mentioned the technological possibilities that we were talking about. And this has been one reason why there has been so much scepticism about the feasibility of amphibious operations periodically for the last several hundred years. And it's led my mentor, Professor Sir Michael Howard, to make one of the few remarks that I actually don't agree with, but it's that. The amphibious diversion, and he was talking about the Gallipoli campaign, a brilliant, almost flawless strategic concept. And here he's making the point, had met the fate of virtually every British amphibious operation since the age of Elizabeth, all brilliant in conception, all lamentable in execution. The surprise and mobility which Liddell Hart had seen as the essence of British maritime strategy, so far from ensuring success, had resulted over the centuries in an almost unbroken record of expensive and humiliating failures, from which Wolfe's seizure of Quebec stands out as one of the few exceptions. He was talking clearly about, largely about Gallipoli and the lessons of Gallipoli, arguing that new technology had taken away many of the possibilities of strategic manoeuvre from the sea. Things like motor transport, things like railways, things like coastal defences of various sorts. And nowadays, of course, the ability to see what's happening at sea much more than in those days. But the lessons that were learned, said Corbett, from the amphibious operation in Gallipoli, particularly the brilliant nature of the evacuation, an extremely difficult operational manoeuvre when in contact with the enemy in any circumstance, and particularly in an amphibious one, actually led, in fact, to the British not making this assumption. They thought, contrary to what you will often read, that amphibious operations were still perfectly feasible if done properly. And here's my evidence. This is the famous, or not so famous, because until recently it's almost largely forgotten, plan to land several divisions of the 4th British Army behind the German lines at some late stage in 1916 or 1917. Here you have an example of operational strategic outflanking. Try to restore movement to operations in the First World War by landing behind the German lines and forcing the Germans to move, restoring, as I say, movement. The problem was that this line of area of coastline from the Yser to Ostend was probably the most heavily defended piece of coast in the world. The British knew this, and they had anticipated the problems of going through it in the light of their dreadful experience in Gallipoli, and were confident that new technology would help them do that. But they were also realistic to the sense that arguing that before they tried that, what they should do was to try and draw German defenders away from the coastline. And so the precondition for this operation was a movement further south from Ypres, going east. And only if that succeeded in sucking German forces away from the coastal area would this be done. Well, we all know that that campaign in 1917, the Passchendaele campaign, failed. It didn't achieve the preconditions. This landing operation never took place. It's one of the great what-ifs of history. If it had taken place, what would have happened? Would it have proved Sir Michael Howard right or Corbett right? We don't know. It's still a subject of debate. But certainly, if you extend that proposition to the Second World War, you can see once again the same pattern of behaviour. Early success, early failures on the British and American side, Norway, Dieppe, Dakar, culminated eventually in success at Normandy and so on. Well, torture really onwards, 1942 onwards. The same pattern across the world in the Pacific. There were problems, huge problems in the conduct of amphibious operations that derived from the nature of the operation, that derived from the fact that it was joint, but led to a succession of successes in the Pacific campaign, which determined the shape of the war and determined eventually its end as well. I won't go into all of that. You know the story is better than I do, no doubt. But the difficulties, the residual difficulties of contested landings against determined opposition, still evident in the ferocious battles at Iwo Jima and Okinawa in the end of that chain of events. But in the hour of its triumph, if you like, this approach to naval warfare was suddenly challenged anew by the impact of atomic weapons. This is a bikini test. Would it be feasible, operationally, technologically, to conduct anything like that in the nuclear age when there was a prospect of weapons like this being used? Would it even be necessary, bearing in mind that the nuclear war was likely to be quite short? Again, major questions. Again, a major psychological shock on the part of naval and marine forces around the world. But once again, the same pattern, as I think applies to the defence and attack of trade. Limited example, Korea, 1950, Suez, 1956, the Falklands, 1982, Desert Storm, 1991, 2003, the Second Iraq War. Limited examples. And it was this that led the US Marine Corps in the 1990s seriously to investigate the possibility of using the seas for strategic manoeuvre, but at the operational level, one down, one level down. And for this, their warfighting laboratory in Quantico took this as an example, a case study to look at. A complex map of the US Civil War in the early 1860s. There you have the northern capital, Washington, not very far away from the southern capital at Richmond. A civil war, the most awful of all wars. Both sides wanted a rapid end to it. Both sides thought the obvious way to get that was to attack the other side's capital. That made the area between the two capitals a natural centre of gravity. Neither side was able to secure a quick and decisive victory. Both sides realised that they were in for a long, ferocious, and terribly costly war. On the north, General McClelland, 36 years old, commander-in-chief of the forces of the Unionist forces, suggested to President Lincoln something very radical. Why not seek to exploit the fact that the Northern Navy was much stronger than the Confederate Navy, and take an army down the river through the Chesapeake Bay, land them at the bottom of what's known as the Virginia Peninsula at Fort Monroe, and advance overland towards Richmond from behind, completely outflanking at the operational level, even strategic level, General Lee's forces that were threatening Washington. Seize Richmond before Lee had chance to fall back and defend it. It would transform the war. It would end it decisively. A very bold idea. Lincoln took some persuading, and his army experts even more, but that's what they did. This was the biggest amphibious operation ever conducted before Normandy. 144,000 men, hundreds of ships, all did exactly that. They landed at Fort Henry at the bottom of the peninsula. Fort Monroe at the bottom of the peninsula. But thereafter, things went wrong. Instead of a speedy advance up that peninsula, which as you can see is marked on the south by the James River and on the north by the York River, things went very much more slowly. The siege of Yorktown took longer to overcome, partly because there weren't enough naval ships present in order to level the odds, if you like, between the attacker and the defender. Yorktown was a very strong point. Same thing happened in Williamsburg a little later. So it all took longer. And in effect, the length of time it all took allowed Lee to fall back and defend Richmond in a series of battles to the northwest of Richmond sorry, in the northeast of Richmond, which were just like the battles that had previously taken place in Manassas and elsewhere, where neither side had a decisive advantage. But McClellan wasn't defeated, and he came out with another really dramatic and radical idea, which was to send a squadron up the James River and to attack Richmond from the riverside. And that, indeed, was they attempted to do. And it could have succeeded. There was a bend in the river below a 400-foot bluff cliff above the river at a place called Drury's Bluff that stopped them. And the reason for that was that the South had an artillery battery on the top of the cliff and were able to stop the ships getting round the corner in the river. The Marines said, what is the lesson of this? The idea of ship-to-objective manoeuvre, STOM, as it became known, was so exciting. There must be a way of making it work. So why didn't it work this time? Answer very simple. They hadn't landed any troops south of that artillery battery. If they had, and had attacked the battery from behind, destroyed the battery, then the Navy could have got through and Richmond would have fallen. Interesting idea. So, what were the lessons of all of this? I could have talked much more about this, but I won't. You've got to have the right kind of sea control. The Battle of the Hampton Roads, that historic battle between ironclads, the Monitor and the Merrimack, or the Virginia, as it's properly called, hadn't achieved sufficient sea control for the North, and therefore they couldn't devote sufficient of their ships to directly supporting the landing operation. They couldn't do that enough. They couldn't also take that battery with a joint operation with the Army and properly. It was the Army and the Navy doing two separate things, if you like. The supply system was slower than it should have been. The ship-to-objective manoeuvre failed, therefore, but it was still an idea that needed to be explored. Instead of a two-step process, you create a bridgehead, you then advance on the objective, you go straight to the objective using the latest technology. McClellan always thought he was against more forces than he actually was. He was more cautious than he needed to have been. But once again, the withdrawal when the operation was abandoned, brilliantly successful. So, the new emphasis, if you like, was on contained, limited, tailored amphibious operations, and we've seen lots of examples of that. But still, the proposition that these days full-scale war of the traditional sort between major maritime powers is much less likely than it seemed to have been in the past has led to a whole growth of new emphases for navies. And I'll just quickly go through these. Maintaining the good order at sea on which trade depends. War is still a possibility, so deterrence of war and prevention of war through maintaining an at-sea deterrent, through defending against it with the creation of ballistic missile defence system, one sort or another, increasingly important. The use of navies with achieving the national objectives by means short of the use of lethal force. In a world in which the use of lethal force is increasingly expensive, increasingly controversial politically, becomes more attractive. And here we get to the last point I want to make, which is fundamentally that all of these three, plus the defence of attack and of trade, plus maritime power projection, all depend on one precondition, which I've mentioned several times, and that really is sea control. The ability to determine the rules at sea. It's essential for all naval operations. It's so important that it's seduced some observers and some writers to think that that's what navies are for. It isn't. This is simply a precondition for what they have to do. And that's a fundamental point that in particular, Corbett constantly went on, it's a precondition for success in everything, every opportunity that the sea offers. Hence its importance, hence the focus of navies on this precondition, which has sometimes obscured the fact that it is no more than a precondition. It requires access. It requires the need to get to where navies need to be in order to achieve their various functions. And it's been influenced, the battle for access, if you like, has been influenced by a whole series of things, most obviously technology. The arrival of the big gun, the all-big gun ship, which revolutionised naval construction in 1904-1905, which meant that naval battles through the First World War and into the early part of the Second World War, essentially artillery duels at sea. The arrival of submarines, aircraft, producing results like this, the sinking of much of the Italian fleet at the Battle of Taranto in 1940, where 12 swordfish inflicted more damage on the battle fleet than the whole of the British Grand Fleet had managed to do in the Battle of Jutland. Carried further one stage further in 1942, at the Battle of the Coral Sea, the first battle in history, in which the ships on each side didn't even see each other. The action was conducted by aircraft operated from ships. So clearly technology has been critical. But there have been other influences as well. Maritime geography, the style of battle for sea control has been shaped by more than just technology, skill, the commander's ability and so on. Operations in the open ocean, fundamentally different from operations in the narrow seas and the littoral area, as we saw with that previous example of the Norwegians, for example. Context and purposes. What the aim of the exercise, why do navies want sea control, has been an important determinant as well. In the Battle of Jutland, for example, in 1916, the Germans were, because of the context, cautious. They were against a superior fleet, and if it seemed that they were going to have to deal with the whole of that fleet, then they would retreat, which is exactly what they did. The British, for their part, already had sea control. And so Admiral Jellicoe was unwilling to take risks simply to improve it. And hence the ambiguous result of 1916. Compare that to Midway in 1942, where both the US and the Japanese were prepared to risk everything for a decisive clash that would determine the shape of the rest of the war. Completely different style of war, if you like. Not brought about by technology, although that was very different, but by the different strategic contexts in which those battles were fought. All of this can be illustrated by the current debate about this and how to respond to it. China, the A2 AD sea denial challenge to classical thinking about naval battle. Big subject, very quickly. What the Chinese are proposing, we think, is a combination of defensive responses that would deny the sea to, let's be clear, the Americans, by exploiting technology, particularly basing what they do on maritime geography, the first and the second island chains, as you can see, and secondly, on the basis of new technology. Much of it, modern versions of familiar stuff, fast attack craft, coastal submarines, mine warfare, land-based aviation, and so on. Particularly these days, the new areas of cyber war and the DF-21D, the so-called carrier killer guided ballistic missile, intended for operations against American carriers. This is sea denial. If the United States is unable to maintain a strategic presence, particularly within the first island chain, then the strategic context changes. If it feels it to be an area of hazard, political circumstances change, allies start doubting the security of the guarantee, the United States begins to fall back. So a whole series of debates about how to respond to this, if you like. One of them is, if you like, to take the challenge on frontally by investing heavily in new technology across all the domains. Not just naval, but cyberspace, space, land and air. All domain access, they call it. JAMGC, it's known as these days, not the air sea battle. But it's a systemic approach of all the disciplines and all the domains of warfare, taking on a similar systemic challenge from the Chinese side. Other suggestions? Why engage in something so escalatory that might include preemptive strikes against Chinese bases? Why not simply sit on the second island chain and stop the Chinese Navy and Chinese merchant ships getting out to the rest of the world? A commercial blockade. Maybe the answer to this is to fall back on the defence of trade. Exploit President Hu's Malacca dilemma. So, in conclusion, what am I saying? I'm saying that naval warfare has varied enormously. There are constants, but there are things that constantly change as well. And one of them, clearly, has been technology. It seems to me that one of the things that technology has done is to clearly have an impact on how traditional functions are performed. I think that's a fairly obvious point that I won't need to labour. But it is still a question of the historic naval functions. More interesting, I think, is the fact that technology and other factors have had a major influence on what functions are performed. What choices navies have to make in the palette of options that they face. One thing I think that is increasingly clear is that technology plus the other contextual conditions is compressing the processes of naval war. Mahan and Corbett both thought in sequential terms. First sea control, then the capacity to exploit it, defence and attack of trade, maritime power projection. But these days, not least because of the arrival of nuclear weapons, but for other reasons too, more and more it's a question of doing them simultaneously, at the same time. Thus, when the Argentines in 1982 refused to accept an air battle before the British landed, they forced the British reoccupation of the Falkland Islands to be conducted while conducting a battle for air supremacy, which made it much more difficult for the British to succeed than it would have been if they'd accepted a sequential approach. I think that's one of the major changes that we're seeing. More and more navies are being constrained by that, by the choices that follow from that act of compression. Another point I would say that technology in this shape is civilian as well as military. I pointed out the function of the container, for example, as being central to the transformation of the nature of the trading world. You could say that cyber war is something that, is largely civilian in origin, but has huge military potential. Is another example of the same sort of thing. And then lastly, the fact that the only thing that's permanent is change. But much remains the same, but the naval planner in every country, in every world's biggest problem is that things don't stay the same. And that trying to anticipate the direction of the future is extremely difficult. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you.